Does the Bible say anything about politics and government? Yes, it does. There really are biblical principles for government. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. 2 Corinthians 3 verse 17. We know that the only hope for Africa is to return in repentance to God, to rediscover the biblical agenda, and to restore biblical principles into every aspect of personal and community life. Now, many people are laboring under the illusion that the Bible has nothing to say concerning social structures, constitutional models, or political affairs. In fact, I remember one of the first courses I ever ran, one of the first frontline camps, one of our hermeneutics lecture notes actually said that, because that's what I'd learned at college. The Bible says nothing about economics or politics. I wrote that in my own lecture notes because that's what I was taught at college. The Bible has nothing to say about politics or economics. Well, as you noticed from Charles' lecture, the Bible actually says a lot about economics. Do you know that Jesus spoke more about money than any other single subject? Do you know that the Bible has over 700 references and passages just on economics, just on finances and money? 700 references. I mean, to say the Bible says nothing about economics is a bit bizarre, because what about the command, you shall not steal, you shall not covet your neighbor's goods? Well, that's economics right there. Well, some theologians have actually worked this out, that approximately 29% of the Bible deals with personal spiritual matters, but 71% of the Bible deals with social, political, and national issues. Wow, that's interesting. So how is it possible that the Bible has nothing to say about social, political, and national issues if 71% of the Bible is dealing with social, political, and national issues? The Bible is not just dealing with spiritual issues, it's dealing with social issues as well. God has instituted four spheres of government. First of all, there's self-government. Self-government symbolized by a conscience. When the Bible speaks of government, it's not just meaning the civil government, it's referring to different types of government. In fact, what's the key verse for Christmas? Isaiah 9 verse 6. Can anyone give that to us? Isaiah 9 verse 6. That's it. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders. Now, when the Bible speaks of the government, capital G, it's talking about God. God's the one who determines when the sun rises, when the sun sets, when the rain falls, when the tides are at what particular point. God is the one who determines when our life begins, when our life ends. These things are in God's hands. He is the government. And then, of course, you've got self-government, and you've got other governments right down to civil, national, municipal, and other provincial governments. But to speak of the government, like our national government is the government, well, that's the mentality of the newspaper headline that said farmers to see government over drought, as though any civil government can do anything at all about drought besides calling for National Day of Repentance and Prayer. So the first government is self-government. The more self-governed you are, the more self-disciplined you are, the less you need other forms of government from the outside. In other words, if you'll get out of bed on your own, you don't need to be kicked out of bed. Last year, Charles and I literally, physically had to carry some people out of their beds and pull them off their mattresses onto the floor, gadunk, because they didn't have the self-government to be able to physically get out of bed. They needed to be gadunked, pulled by the feet onto the floor. Others needed to be thrown to the pool so that they could wake up. If you are self-disciplined, you don't need that. If you all just turn up on time and you brush your own teeth and you comb your own hair and you wash yourself and you behave and you've got good hygiene, then we don't have to do it for you. Hence, no one's been thrown in the pool yet. Extraordinary. Family government is the second form of government. In fact, the first government most of us ever experience is family government. Now, while self-government's got the conscience, family government's got the rod of discipline. Now, it's not to say that the only way the government works is with the rod of discipline. That's an extreme case. But while there's different forms of discipline that can be used, if the child does not listen at a certain point, he can feel the rod of discipline, showing that this is, of course, a flexible instrument. It's not an iron bar. It's not something that kills. It's something that just stings enough to get the message over and to reinforce the principle. You get church government. And the church has got the keys of church discipline. Ultimately, the church can excommunicate. That's an extreme thing. Churches don't excommunicate first thing off, or they shouldn't. There is all kinds of things from teaching, admonition, rebuke, counseling. You can even suspend people from certain functions in church. Ultimately, when they are unresponsive, unrepentant, and you've exhausted all means, you can excommunicate even, meaning the keys of church discipline symbolize church government. So you get self-government, you get family government, you get church government, and yes, you get civil government. Trouble is, most people, when they hear government, they think only the fourth, they think civil government. And of course, the more self-governed you have a society, the stronger the families, the more effective the churches, the less the government, the civil government needs to do. When you've got a society where families have broken to pieces, churches aren't doing their job, and individuals are undisciplined, then you'll find the government's got to do almost everything. Civil government has got to be everything from mommy and daddy and the church as well, because all the other three branches of government have fallen apart. Now, it's not a matter that each of these forms of government are above or under one another. They're all separate, overlapping, and all of them are under God, every one. So, God has established in the government of Israel 10 key principles of freedom. Those people who say there's no constitutional models in the Bible, well, let me give you 10 constitutional models, 10 key principles of freedom that you will find in the Bible that God established in the nation of Israel as a model and as an inspiration, as an example to us. First of all, a written constitution, a covenant based upon the revealed word of God. Israel had a covenant with God, seen in Exodus and in Deuteronomy 5 verse 8. As Jesus said in John 19 verse 11 to Pontius Pilate, you would have no authority unless it was given to you from above. A government has no authority unless it is delegated authority, first of all from God. A biblical constitution will clearly define and restrict the powers of government. It should act as a chain to keep the rulers from abusing power. It must be written so that it is specific, so that it is clear, and it is permanent. The American government at the moment has one of the most effective constitutions. Their constitution has lasted something in the region of 220-odd years. That's extraordinary, because Africa's gone through 600 constitutions in the last 45 years and still seems to be going through them at a spectacular rate. So constitutions in Africa seem to be temporary suggestions rather than something that's a permanent chain to restrict government. The American Constitution is a pretty effective one because it has acted as a good check and balance. Take, for example, 4 years ago when America had an election and they had such a close tie that at the end they weren't even sure who was the president. And for several weeks there was uncertainty and there was confusion, there was chaos. And America managed through the different checks and balances to go through this crisis and elect a new president without bodies in the street, without tanks being mobilized, without a civil war, without a chaos, without coup d'etat. Extraordinary. If that kind of confusion had happened in most countries in the world, there would have been a civil war and there would have been a lot of dead bodies in the streets, burning buildings. And remember when Russia had a constitutional problem and Yeltsin and Gorbachev having an argument, and next thing you knew, the tanks were shelling their parliament building. And I mean, that's what happens in most countries in the world. That's what happens in South America. That's the sort of thing that's normal when there's any kind of uncertainty in a country over something as important as a change of government. But in America, they've got such an effective system that even at that incredibly close year 2000 election, they managed to have a transition of power without anybody getting killed. Incredible. A peaceful transfer of power, even in a time when the election was that close. That's an effective constitution. Psalm 19, verse 7 to 10 says, "The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commandments of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever." The best foundation for any country is a biblical constitution, such as, for example, the dooms set in by King Alfred the Great of England, where he had the law of God as a foundation, the Magna Carta, which was forced, written by Stephen Langton, the pastor, Archbishop of Canterbury at the time, on King John the First of England, and the Bill of Rights, of course, that the American government instituted, and many others we can think of that were effective. I might add that the constitution we have in South Africa at the moment is a pretty poor constitution because it has very little restriction on government. And it's got fraudulent separation of powers because effectively, instead of a true separation of powers and a true federal system that we're meant to have, what we've got in South Africa at the moment is the president in Pretoria decides who the mayor is going to be in Cape Town. Cape Townians no longer elect their mayor. We don't elect anything. I mean, every single premier in the country and every major metropolis's mayor has been chosen by the president. The local people no longer have a choice. Your municipal rights have been eroded. So the separation of powers is no longer there at all, whereas it used to be. Not only that, but bear in mind that the Southern Constitution doesn't really restrict the powers of government that much. All it does is define how they're going to make the rules, which isn't what a constitution is meant to be. A constitution is meant to be a true check and balance where the judiciary is independent of the executive, which is independent of the legislature, which act as tension between one another, and the municipalities and the provinces all have true independence with their own tax basis, and they can even have, in many cases, their own police forces, and they can work as a check and balance against centralization of power. A written constitution is the first step to a free country. Secondly, you need a separation of powers and functions into three branches of civil government: the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. In Israel, the executive was the king. First you had a judge, and then you had a king. Then the legislative was the council and the Sanhedrin, and the judicial were the elders or judges in each community. Now, these three functions of government are based on how the Lord revealed his government. Remember, the government will be upon his shoulders. Isaiah 33 verse 22 says, "For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, and the Lord is our king. He will save us." And so God, being perfect, can centralize all branch of government in himself without corruption. But man, being depraved and sinful, cannot. Therefore, Christians from the beginning have recognized the need to divide government. And that is why in England, you've got the Queen separate from the House of Commons and the House of Lords, separate from the judiciary. So Old Bailey is there, and the House of Commons is there, and the House of Lords is there, and the Queen is there. And if the House of Commons passes a law, it's got to be approved by the House of Commons. Laws have to be approved by the House of Lords, or they can refine, change, alter, or throw it back to them, or veto it. Even at the end, once both Houses of Parliament have approved it, the Queen has to sign it. You've got to check and balance. Even then, the judiciary can decide this isn't really acceptable in terms of the common law of England, and they could throw it out too. So you've got to check and balance there. That didn't come about through the wisdom of the British or something like that. It came about from biblical study. They just looked and they saw, well, the Bible divides God's government into executive, legislative, and judicial. So must we. Hence, in South Africa, we have our judicial capital in Bloemfontein, our legislative capital in Cape Town, our executive capital in Pretoria. We've physically separated the powers of government across 1,400 kilometers. That frustrates socialists no end. They want to have a centralized capital for South Africa, and so there's been a tremendous push from the beginning. I remember also debating our dear friend Carl Niehaus of the ANC on this very issue in the presence of Nelson Mandela when we were at his place back in 1995. And in fact, it was Carl Niehaus was saying, we will have to move Parliament from Cape Town. They wanted to move it to Midrand. They didn't want it in Pretoria, too identified to the old government. Didn't want Joburg, too much of a mess. They wanted Midrand, start a new capital right there. We said, well, what about your promise of housing? You're going to provide housing for everyone? This is going to cost more money than it would cost to provide housing for a couple of million people in this country. Did you move just the archives from Cape Town up there? You don't even have you don't have anything in Midrand, facilities-wise, in order to accommodate all the a branch of government, especially with the bloated, expanded governments we've got these days. So anyway, they were wanting to do it right then and there, but they've been forced to delay their plans just because of the fact that economic reality has set in. We need a separation of powers. The best separation of powers that you'll get anywhere in the world is in Switzerland. The Swiss have separated their powers so brilliantly over there that can anybody name the president of Switzerland? Trick question. Not even a Swiss could name the president of Switzerland. It changes every month. Every single month the president changes because it's a very ceremonial position. The governor of each canton, and there's about 26 cantons, gets a turn just by rotation. And so they don't have any head of state. You can be there long enough to exploit anybody because it's very much a ceremonial position. And so I saw down at the waterfront, they've got some plaque there. Somebody unknown, president of Switzerland, was there. Well, maybe he's the president for that month, but it's a bit of an anomaly. Nobody in Switzerland can have a picture of the president on the wall because they're not even that sure who is the president for that month. It just keeps changing. You may think that that's not tremendous for stability, but it's brilliant for freedom. They're not there long enough to get corrupt. Thirdly, you need an independent judiciary. So the first is a written constitution. The second is a separation of powers. And the third is an independent judiciary with a right to a fair trial. Notice Chronicles 19, verse 5 to 7. He appointed judges in the land. He told them, consider carefully what you do, because you're not judging for man, but for the Lord, who is with you whenever you give a verdict. Now, let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Judge carefully, for with the Lord our God, there is no injustice or partiality or bribery. Wow. That's the kind of instructions we'd like given to our judges. In Deuteronomy 19, verse 15 to 19, the principles for a fair trial are set out. Number one, you're innocent until proven guilty. This is not something the Americans invented. It's something the Americans just put into their law because they saw it was a biblical principle from Deuteronomy. Isn't it interesting how people today keep trying to avoid books like Deuteronomy and Leviticus because there's God's laws in there. No wonder they don't want people to read Leviticus and Deuteronomy. But there's a lot of fascinating material in there if you're interested in economics, if you're interested in prosperity, if you're interested in justice. So number one, you're innocent until proven guilty. Proven guilty. Beyond a shadow of a doubt. Number two, right to due process of law. It means even if you know that this guy's guilty, you caught him in the very act. You can't take him out and lynch him. You've got to go through the due process of law. Give chance for defense, give opportunity to evidence, check the evidence, rule of law, chance to cross-examine the witnesses. Why? Because sometimes what you think you saw isn't necessarily the whole story. Sometimes you can be so sure this person's guilty, and meanwhile, you can end up hanging an innocent person. So the Bible fits in the due process of law. You've got to be absolutely sure. The man needs his day in court. And he has the right to personally confront his accusers. He has the right to cross-examine them. He has the right to call witnesses to his defense. And so all these principles are written into God's law. Witnesses must personally confront the accused. Anonymous accusations are unacceptable. None of the secret anonymous accusations business like was used in the Soviet Union. Although they've brought that back into South Africa right now. You can apparently rat on your neighbors for the crime of using your borehole water or something like that for your own grass. So now we are recruiting little Stasi, KGB, little Gestapo informants in our own society. That's right. You can rat on somebody and tell on. I think that my neighbor's not paying all his taxes or something like that. Right. So witnesses must personally confront the accused. Fourthly, a matter must be established by two or three witnesses. None of this business of having one person being the source or one source of evidence. You need confirming evidence. Now, that doesn't mean two or three people have to see it. For example, if you get the fingerprints of the assailant on the weapon and the ballistics that proves that this is the weapon that, okay, this gun killed this person. The ballistics have established that scientifically. The fingerprints have been found on the gun to match the accused. The accused had opportunity to do it. He was, he doesn't have any hard cast alibi that he wasn't at the scene of the crime. There is no doubt the accused, the victim died at this time. The man had opportunity and he had reason. Now you look at the different things. You know, there's motive, there's opportunity, there's the weapon, there's the scientific links. We've got the fingerprints. Now those are two or three witnesses. You don't necessarily have to have somebody who saw it. These days with science, you can say, well, we've got DNA samples from under the fingernails of the victim that match that of the rapist. I mean, DNA samples from the skin cells that's been raked off by fingernails, that's proof in court. That's enough to hang the guy. You can go scientific evidence, but the principle is two or three witnesses. You don't just trust one, because Sometimes evidence can be planted. Sometimes the person could be set up. There can be falsified evidence. There can be completely, sometimes a person can be in every way set up, even scientifically. So you need more than one evidence. You've got to cross-examine to a point where it's beyond a reasonable doubt. And fifthly, judges must be impartial. This may sound obvious, but I remember reading back in 1980s the Constitution of Mozambique at that time, that judges had to be uneducated. That was a constitutional requirement by law in Mozambique, uneducated, and they had to be members of the Frelimo party. Why? Because an educated judge would discriminate against educated people, uneducated people, and he had to be a member of the party. So we've got testimonies of how court cases were done in Mozambique under Frelimo in 1975 to 77 during the Red Terror. Commissar would wander around with his Tokarev pistol, which, if you know anything about weapons, doesn't have a safety catch. And it would be cocked, hammered back, and he'd be waving this Tokarev around in people's faces, you know, sort of all ducking as it waves past you. And a finger would be on a trigger, of course. Didn't learn the idea of having a finger to the side of the trigger guard. And ranting and raving about this counter-revolutionary, reactionary, or black marketeer. And ranting and raving, and then at a certain point, the commissar would say, "What do you say?" And everyone would shout, "Guilty." "I can't hear you." "Guilty, guilty." "More, guilty, guilty." They chant, "Guilty." "What shall be his punishment?" "Death." And put the gun to the guy's head and blow his brains out. Judge, jury, prosecutor, everything. One guy, commissar. Uneducated, of course, but he is a Frelimo party member, so that's important. No due process, no rules of evidence. 75,000 people were publicly executed in Mozambique in that way. This just in 2 years. That was the constitutional method of court cases done in Mozambique back during the Red Terror under Samora Machel, 1975 to 1977. How many innocent people died amongst the 75,000? Probably all of them. But this is why you need independent judiciary. You're innocent until proven guilty. You have the right to due process of law. Witnesses must personally confront the accused. A matter must be established by two or three witnesses. Judges must be impartial. This is rock-solid foundational stuff. Miscarriage of justice is easy. True justice, biblical justice, takes a lot of hard work. And so, the fourth principle of freedom that was set up by the Lord in the nation of Israel was a national legislature, a lawmaking body, where one house was composed of representative judges or officials elected by the people. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials. We have this verse, Exodus 18, verse 21, on our biblical voters guides, which Africa Christian Action has been printing since 1992. It's on our websites and everywhere. Some people got quite upset about this because this is very discriminatory. I mean, what do you mean that they've got to be capable? And that would disqualify just about everyone in Parliament, just for starters. And they've got to fear God? Whoa. Trustworthy men? You've got to be kidding. We wouldn't have any of our candidates elected then. Men who hate dishonest gain? What do you mean they love dishonest gain? So Exodus 18:21 kind of disqualifies almost everybody in Parliament right now, which is an excellent reason why it's in the scripture and why we've got it on our website and why we put it there on the voters' guides. The biblical principle for electing representatives is, first of all, is the guy capable? Can he do the job? What's his track record? Why should he be Minister of Finance? Well, he's organized stayaways and boycotts, and he's destroyed some businesses. You know, the old National Party government, they used to elect ministers of finance who had bankrupted their own businesses several times over. We had several Minister of Finances like that. They'd never run a successful business, and now they were put in charge of the economy of the country. Today we've got Trevor Manuel, who's never run a business, but he has organized boycotts and stayaways, and as a trade union leader, he has worked against some businesses. And yet he, funnily enough, seems to be doing a better job because of the advisors he's employed than some of the guys before him. Nevertheless, you really would like to have a capable man in each job. And if they don't fear God, and if they're not trustworthy, and if they're not incorruptible, why would we want them in government? Fifthly, we need a second house in the legislature, in the lawmaking body, which is composed of in the case of Israel, two hereditary elders from each of the 11 tribes or geographic areas, in addition to 24 priests from the tribe of Levi, and two lawyers or scribes from each of the 12 tribes. This was an unelected body, but it was an appointed body. Totaling 70 men became known as the Sanhedrin. So you had the council, which was directly elected, and then you had the Sanhedrin, which was appointed. How does this work out? In Britain, this second house is the House of Lords. In America, this second house is the Senate. In South Africa, the second house, the National Council of Provinces. The problem is in our country, it's not a separate election that elects the National Council of Provinces. They're appointed by their party on the basis of the elections in the lower house. So it's a bit of a trick. In South Africa, it looks like you've got separation of powers, but actually it all comes back to the same guy. He sits up there in Pretoria and Union buildings, and he decides who the mayor is in Cape Town and who's the premier of this province and who's going to be the representative. That's not the way it's meant to work. They've got the outward shell, but they've gutted the inside of the way it's meant to work. But biblically, the second house, the Sanhedrin, was appointed. Now, in America, you've got the Senate. The senators are elected for 6 years, whereas the House of Representatives is elected for 2 years. The senators must be older. I think they've got to be 35 years old minimum. The senators, there are two per state. So California, which is a massive state with a huge population, gets two senators. North Dakota, which is a miniature little state, next to no population, they also get two senators. Connecticut, which is so minute, you could lose them in Cape Peninsula probably, they also get two senators, and Arizona gets two. So what is this doing? It means the Senate represents the rural areas more balanced, whereas the lower house would represent the population centers where you've got a higher population. For example, in our country, you'd have a massive amount of people voting in Johannesburg and Cape Town and so on, because those are big centers, but then the rural areas would be neglected. So if the National Council of Provinces or Senate or House of Lords has equal representations from districts, irregardless of the population density, it means that you're spreading a check and balance system to a degree that where the intense population is, they've got more representatives in the lower house. But each area, each province, each state, in the case of America, will have an equal representation in the upper house. And in Israel, that was each tribe. And then, of course, the tribe of Levi, being special tribe, being the priest, they were given double amount. So that's an interesting way how they set it out. Now, in Britain, you've got the bishops are in the House of Lords. You've got the lords that are in the House of Lords. You've got the justices who are in the House of Lords. So the House of Lords has got a bunch of people who like hereditary chiefs. How does this work out in Africa? You go to Swaziland. They have got a king. He is a monarch, but he's got to rule in accordance with the constitution. They've got a written constitution, and he's got a council of elders that he must listen to. In addition to which, he's got the queen mother, who he must listen to too. The queen mother's got a serious executive powers. The council of elders or chiefs has got a serious amount of powers, and they've got a parliament. Now, the parliament, interesting enough, in Swaziland, is not allowed to be on a party basis. You can elect individuals. Each individual represents a constituency, but there's no parties. Every single member of parliament is an independent by law in Swaziland, because they say parties will bring unnecessary division. Very interesting. In Swaziland, they only have representative members of parliament. In South Africa, we only have party members who can be a member of parliament. So we've got a very different way of doing it. But can you see Swaziland's drawn biblical principles from this? That's how they've got a constitutional monarchy with a parliament, with a council of elders, and the king and the queen mother working together. Swaziland just happens to be one of the most peaceful countries with one of the lowest crime rates around, and God has certainly blessed their checks and balances very well. Number six, you need an executive officer. In the book of Judges, it was a judge. A judge was not so much a judicial judge as much as a military executive position. And so the judge worked back in the book of Judges, and then you had the king, starting with Saul, David, Solomon, and so on. And they were elected with the guidance of God and a consent of the elders. Now observe here, the executive officer biblically is not elected directly by the people. The executive officer is elected by the elders in accordance with the guidance of God. When all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron, he made a compact or covenant with him before the Lord, and they anointed David king of Israel as the Lord had promised through Samuel. That's in 1 Chronicles 11 verse 3. So the biblical concept of an executive office is one who is not directly elected by the people. How does this work out? Well, in England, you've got a queen who is not elected by the people, but she is an executive officer. Her House of Commons is directly elected by the people. And the House of Lords are the chiefs of England. They're the hereditary royals. They are the nobles, the bishops, and so on. So you've got tradition in the House of Lords. You've got popular elected representatives in the House of Commons bumping heads nicely, check and balance. So you've got tradition trying to say, whoa, putting on the brakes. You've got the elected guys trying to, let's have a cultural revolution here. So you've got a bit of change and a bit of restraint working together. That's not bad. And you've got a queen who if she used her powers wisely, which she unfortunately hasn't, she could also put a check and balance on it. Unfortunately, in England, it hasn't worked too well because the queen has shown little moral backbone. She signed everything they brought before, including legalization of abortion in 1968, abolition of death penalty for murderers, and all sorts of other bizarre things. She's brought in legalized pornography. So the Queen of England has happily signed every cultural revolution, humanistic, antichrist document in violation of a coronation oath. When a queen was crowned in England, she had to swear before Almighty God on the Bible to uphold the constitution, the laws of England, and and to rule in the light of the sovereign rule of Jesus Christ as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, in accordance with all the laws and commands in God's holy word, the Bible. I mean, she had to swear to rule in accordance with the Bible under the kingship of King Jesus. That was the coronation oath of Queen Elizabeth. She's, of course, violated that coronation oath multiple times over and hasn't even had the decency to call for a national day of prayer and repentance once in her 52 or 53 years of being queen. So in my book, while I would think that it's fine to have a monarchy in principle here and there, constitutional monarchy, at the moment the present individual is a terribly bad representative of it, but nevertheless, at least the British have got a very appropriate national anthem, God Save the Queen. Indeed, we do pray that he may do it not only for her but for her whole family, who have reinterpreted the whole meaning of dysfunctional. In fact, they defined what a dysfunctional family is. Nevertheless, monarchies can work well in accordance with the parliament, as was shown under Queen Victoria. Queen Victoria was an extremely positive and effective monarch, and her husband, Prince Albert, was spectacularly effective as an evangelical Christian and as an example of a God-fearing father, a family man, a lot of what they did as a couple and as a monarchy was very positive. Nevertheless, America now has a president being elected, and he is elected directly by the people. Notice in South Africa, the president is not directly elected by the people. The president is whoever's the head of the majority party. So you don't really have a check and balance, because in America you can have a Republican president and a Democratic House of Representatives. You can have a Democratic president and a Republican Senate and House of Representatives. I mean, you can have all kinds of combinations. And then the Supreme Court can still throw a spanner in the works by complicating their life and vetoing things they've done. So in America, you've got a real check and balance. And then each governor's got his own national guard, and you've got their own legislatures in each of the states, the 50 states. So America, each state's got their own flag, even. Each state's got their own police force. So America's got a lot of checks and balances, and Switzerland's got even more. Switzerland's checks and balances are even more superb, and they're the ones who invented the referendum, by the way. So all of these principles, though, have derived from biblical principles. We might have the outward shell in South Africa, but we've gutted the inner workings of it. Right. You need a decentralized state. This is the seventh point. Biblical principle is a decentralized state with most responsibilities and powers resting on the local government, the family, and the individual. Centralization of power in a unitary state has always been a pagan tendency, as is seen in Nineveh and Babel. Pagan states centralize. Biblical states decentralize. Switzerland is the ultimate example of a decentralized state. In fact, you don't even know where the government is. They're so small. National governments there primarily for national defense, and that's about all. They don't do particularly much. They don't even have to do the police force because that's in the hand of the local cantons or provinces. So, as power corrupts, it's wise to limit and divide the powers of civil government in a system of checks and balances. So, decentralized state is the biblical model. Just think of it this way. If you haven't lived in municipalities, maybe you've missed this, but in Cape Town before, we used to have every different area had their own municipality. Para was a municipality in its own. Bellville was a municipality in its own. Pinelands was a municipality in its own. We had our own town hall, we had our own mayor, we had our own town council. If you wanted to do something in Pinelands, you'd go down the road to the municipality. You know the town councillors and probably the mayor, they might be neighbors. A guy might go to your church. The community, which is only 4,000 homes in Pinelands, 15,000 people in total, they could control their government. Paro, the guys knew the mayors and the town councillors and so on, and they could get accountability. And if something is wrong, you could say, what is your case? How come you guys can't deal with litter removal? And why is that the plants on the island dying of dehydration there? When are you guys going to get your act together? That tree that got chopped down over there, when are you going to plant some more ones? The whole community could interact with the municipality. But now with the Unicity, you've got a bunch of incompetent, couldn't care less, I don't know, type sitting down there in town. You've got to go through who knows how long a traffic jam in order to get into this parking chaos, pay some parking tickets, go up, find the right place, sorry, wrong window, down this hallway, that place, the man with the key's not here, out for lunch, and it carries on and on. And at the end of it, he doesn't know, he doesn't care, and it's not his department anyway. Come back after the new year, and it just carries on. So you can go from an efficient, decentralized system to a Unicity, which is only efficient in stealing the taxes and not delivering any services and letting some fat cat bureaucrats get out there onto the golf courses and give service to the brothels and do absolutely no services to the communities that they're meant to be helping. That's the difference. Centralization is pagan. Decentralization is biblical. You get the picture. Okay. Eighth point for a free state is a citizens' army, a militia made up of trained citizens who've got the right and the duty to bear arms for the defense of their home, the family, the community, and their nation. One of the best safeguards against tyranny is an armed citizenry. If a government fears weapons in the hands of its people, the people should fear power in the hands of the government. A government that doesn't trust its citizens to have weapons cannot be trusted with power. Simple and citizens' army. We used to have our commando system in South Africa. They're trying to dismantle it now. Israel's got a citizens' army. Switzerland doesn't have an army. Switzerland is an army. Every male citizen is part of the army, right until he's 65. Then he goes on to the sea reserve. But he's still expected to be available if they need. Switzerland had the highest mobilization of any nation in history during the Second World War. They mobilized 20% of their citizens, which represented like almost all of the men in the entire country. 20% of the citizens. When you consider how many were children, how many were women, I mean, that's just extraordinary. No other country came close to Switzerland's mobilization. You wonder why Switzerland wasn't invaded? I mean, Holland was invaded. Norway and Denmark, which were neutral, were invaded. Czechoslovakia was meant to be neutral. They got invaded. Why was Switzerland not invaded? These guys were good shots. They were extremely advanced. The Swiss have put all their technological refinements into producing spectacularly good rifles. They were good airmen. They shot down anyone who came in very effectively, anyone who caused them trouble. I mean, at one time, the French wanted to invade through Switzerland to get to Germany, and they said they'll fight them as much. The British at one point accidentally bombed them. Their air force chased them out. The Germans wanted to take them. The Italians wanted to take them. I mean, these guys had the passes where they could resupply through the Alps. Switzerland was a prize for all sides. And Switzerland resisted the whole bunch because they were totally mobilized. The Swiss work on this principle. Peace comes through superior firepower. If you want peace, prepare for war. The Swiss have prepared for war, and everyone's given them a wide berth for quite a while. Do not be afraid of them, Nehemiah said. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome. Fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. If you've got a totally armed population. You will, A, not have any house breakings. Switzerland has got to have the lowest crime rate in the industrial world. House breakings and attacking women in their homes is unheard of, because these guys have got machine guns and so on in their homes. The Swiss government actually prints guerrilla warfare books that are banned in just about every country in the world on sabotage, how to do demolitions, how to plant landmines, how to blow up bridges, how to make homemade bombs. They've got a whole book on guerrilla warfare, you know, how to make Molotov cocktails, how to take out tanks, how to everything. And the government prints it and distributes it to all its citizens. Every country in the world would make that banned, but in Switzerland, the government produces it. The government sees the people have weapons. Forget about people being free to get weapons. The government gives them weapons. Why? They want freedom. You want a free country? Have an armed citizenry. On the other hand, you can have Rwanda, where everyone is disarmed, and then you have 600,000 to 800,000 people killed with machetes in 6 weeks. Citizens' army, very important for any kind of free state. Local militias elected their own commanders, which we did in South Africa with our commandos until the 1960s. Each soldier supplied his own basic weapons. This is based upon the right of each law-abiding citizen to own and use weapons for self-defense. Still taking this from the Bible, Judges 5, 1 Samuel 13. Any attempt to prohibit the use of an individual, the right of an individual to keep and bear arms, was an unbiblical pagan attempt to centralize or usurp excessive power. The Philistines practiced weapons control. No blacksmiths. There wasn't a sword or a spear to be found in all of Israel at the day when Saul and Jonathan stood up against the Philistines. Why? Because the Philistines had done spear and sword control. Ninthly, you need a free market economy. This was the message given earlier this morning. A free market economy based on private ownership of property and individual free enterprise. Any taxation of 10% or higher was defined as oppression. Any taxation of property is unbiblical. Any government doesn't own property. Any taxation of inheritance is unbiblical. The deceased already paid taxes on this. He has the right to lay up an inheritance for his children, as the biblical Bible mandates. For government to tax inheritance is for them to tax the dead. It's double tax. It's theft. Also, institutions and individuals involved in the full-time service of the Lord are not allowed to be taxed. Why? Because everything that the full-time servant of the Lord has is free will offerings given by people who have already paid their taxes. You may not tax. Here's a free will offering. I mean, if somebody gives me 100 rand and says, I want this to go for Bibles to Angola, I can't put 100 rand to Bibles to Angola, because 14% of that's going to go to sales tax. Even the Bible study has to put sales tax on their Bibles. I mean, this is disgusting. This means the government steals from even consecrated money given unto the Lord in an offering in church. But that's not all. The government gets more out of crime than you do. Because when you buy something, you've got to pay 14% sales tax. When you get your insurance, you've got to pay 14% sales tax. When the thief steals it, and then you've got to replace it, you've got to pay 14% sales tax on the replacement. And you've got to pay sales tax on the payout. So no wonder the government's getting more, not doing anything to stop crime. They're getting a bigger cut out of crime than the criminal is. Any unequal or progressive system of taxation is expressly forbidden. Biblical economics forbids unjust weights and measures, unbacked currency, inflation. And lastly, you need an education program controlled by the parents, aided by the church, but independent of the state. You cannot entrust any state with the molding of the minds of the future voters. The control of education must be in the hands of parents, and the content of education must be moral, character developing, and Bible based. And there's a brilliant quote from Hugo Grotius, a 17th century Dutch theologian. This epitomizes what we're talking about: self-government, family government, church government, and civil government. He knows not how to rule a kingdom that cannot manage a province. Nor can he wield a province that cannot order a city. Nor he order a city that knows not how to regulate a village. Nor he a village that cannot guard a family. Nor can that man govern well a family that knows not how to govern himself. Neither can any govern himself unless his reason be lord and his will and appetites her vassals or servants. Nor can reason rule unless herself be ruled by God and be wholly obedient to him. Now that's a lot of wisdom there. You need to reread that. This whole presentation is in Biblical Principles for Africa, the booklet you should have all got on the first night here. Every word, quote, and reference is in there. And of course, it's on our website as well.